Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of a nurse from involuntary quarantine in New Jersey, as both Governors Christie of New Jersey and New York Governor Cuomo have relented, lifting their impositions of a quarantine on healthcare workers returning from West Africa, which healthcare professionals objected to as being both counterintuitive and counterproductive. Dr. Chris Farrell, an infectious disease physician and researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, joins us to discuss the hysteria that U.S. politicians are both responding to and feeding, which is distracting attention from West Africa, where the real problem is, and preventing and deterring healthcare professionals from going to and from Africa to stop the epidemic before it spreads globally. Then, a week away from the midterm elections, we will look into the key Senate races that will determine who will control the Senate and how soon Barack Obama will become a lame duck president. A specialist on the American right and the presidency, Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at American University who has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984 and is the author of The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president, joins us to talk about Jeb Bush's likely entry into the 2016 presidential race and the wild cards in the upcoming Senate races. Then finally, we'll speak with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, whose forthcoming book is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. We will discuss the likely impact of a letter from 12 Nobel laureates to President Obama urging him to release the long-delayed report on torture prepared by the Senate Intelligence Committee that the CIA has been holding up for years. And joining us now is Claire Farrell, who is an infectious disease physician and researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, where she serves as the medical director for the Infectious Diseases Clinic at UNC Healthcare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Claire Farrell.
Thank you for having me.
And what is your opinion on the hysteria here in the United States over Ebola and the extremely unlikely chance that anybody is going to get infected, which has prompted three states to institute mandatory quarantines, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois, and a medical nurse returning from West Africa working for Médecins Sans Frontières was involuntarily quarantined in New Jersey. She's just been released, and both certainly Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York appears to have yielded to a lot of outrage from medical professionals that this was a counterintuitive thing to do. So what's your opinion, and what do you believe that in this case a little bit of rationality has reversed a counterintuitive decision?
Certainly. So I think you've encompassed it very well. I think that there is a lot of fear about Ebola, and I think that a lot of it is warranted. It's an incredibly terrifying virus. But I think that, especially in the United States, we need to take a step back and recognize that the chances of contracting this virus through casual contact are absolutely minuscule, and that we need to focus our attention on people who are genuinely sick, and we need to make sure not to infringe on the rights and the well-being of healthcare workers who have put themselves on the front lines.
So Dr. Anthony Fauci made the point over the weekend that we should be focusing on where the real problem is, which is in West Africa, where 10,000 people are infected and roughly 5,000 have died already. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, is over there visiting those countries. So do you think that those kind of voices of reason are dampening down this apparent hysteria here in the United States?
Certainly, yeah. I think that when we focus our attention on quarantining people who exhibit no symptoms of the disease, we draw attention away from people who are sick. We discourage people who are sick from seeking care, and we discourage people from coming forward who may have legitimately been exposed to the disease or have concerns about the disease. I think that when we look at the scope of the problem in West Africa, the numbers are staggering, and the infection control challenges are so much different than they are in the United States that it's a little bit like comparing apples and oranges. Everything about the healthcare system here is vastly different than what my colleagues have seen over in West Africa. And I think, you know, a very important thing to remember is that this is not a one-size-fits-all response to the epidemic. So there are responses that are appropriate in the United States and that may not be appropriate or even work in West Africa. And so this is something that we're constantly changing our thoughts about the best approach to, but this does not mean that the public needs to have a mounting degree of concern about their personal safety.
And in terms of your colleagues, Dr. Claire Farrell, who have worked in West Africa with Ebola patients, what's the sense then of whether there is perhaps another way to do quarantine? Is there no possibility of doing quarantine in West Africa? Like, is there not a Club Med where everybody can sort of hang out for 21 days and then fly back to the U.S. without any fear of infecting passengers on aircraft and all that kind of thing, that which is, I think, generating this hysteria here in the United States?
Sure. It's definitely an appealing idea, and I think it's an appealing idea also from an ethical perspective in that we wouldn't be punishing healthcare workers for going to treat people who are in need of help. I think one of the drawbacks is that colleagues who I have at UNC and in other parts of the United States who've responded to the epidemic as healthcare workers are doing so on leave from their day jobs. And I think by mandating 3 weeks of quarantine following that period, by not allowing them to return to their lives and reacclimate, not necessarily taking care of patients in their home state, but at least being part of their daily life in the United States, makes this more punitive than I think it need be. And again, I don't think that there is a one-size-fits-all answer to this, because certainly some people, you know, may identify exposures that necessitate quarantine. But I think for the most part, it's a very difficult thing to make a rule about. I also think that we have to be very careful about the burden that we put on other countries. So, you know, for example, I know there was concern, perhaps legitimately so, about the economic impact of this epidemic on the hospital in Dallas, where so much of this began in the United States. Similarly, I think, you know, even on a small scale, the bowling alley, where one of the most recent cases in New York was identified as a point of contact, these places suffer a pretty big economic hit by their association with Ebola, and I think we have to take that into consideration before trying to send people off to spend their quarantine in commercial businesses.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Claire Farrell, who is an infectious disease physician and researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, where she serves as the medical director for the Infectious Diseases Clinic at UNC Healthcare. But the doctor in New York who sparked the panic and it led to Governor Cuomo's issuing this quarantine, he, of course, is a doctor who was well aware of the possibility since he had worked with Ebola patients in West Africa. So that actually contributes to people's fear, isn't it? If a doctor gets it somehow and he wasn't able to avoid getting it, it really is virulent. Now, I'm not speaking, these are not my opinions, but I think these are fears that are generated, are they not?
Certainly, yes. It's not entirely clear, to me at least, how he became infected. But I think, you know, one of the very important things to consider is that he was around very, very sick people. And I think that really shows how easy it can be to transmit the virus in certain settings. If you're surrounded by people who are dying of this virus, there's a lot of virus in the environment. And following strict infection control procedures certainly reduces that risk. But, you know, people like this doctor are certainly at a much higher degree of risk. And there is never zero risk of transmission, but it can certainly be reduced by infection control procedures. I think that for people like him, it's difficult to say whether or not a quarantine would have been the right thing, because we don't know the details of his exposures. He certainly hadn't identified any. I do think that mandating a 21-day quarantine and isolation for all returning healthcare workers is overkill.
Well, I don't know whether you saw, Dr. Farrell, the 60 Minutes interview with the healthcare workers in in the Dallas hospital who actually handled the patient who came in from Liberia. Did you watch that?
No, I didn't.
Well, it was very, very powerful in the sense that it really shows you the heroic work that healthcare workers do, and it also reinforces the notion that these are the last people that should be punished by hysteria and stigma. But that said, one of the things that was quite grueling about the descriptions is the work that the healthcare workers had to, the conditions under which they had to work in these sort of space suits, dealing with this terminally ill Liberian man, and the extent, and you mentioned it a minute ago, that we're really, when people are very sick from Ebola, it's a very infectious environment, that they were describing how his bodily functions were collapsing and how difficult the cleanup was. It was just, I didn't even want to repeat the stuff that was said, you know, because it's...
No, I can imagine. I can imagine.
Yeah.
No, and I think the data shows that, you know, it is very, very difficult to use this equipment appropriately, which is why, you know, devoting our resources to training people and to making sure that we have really robust systems in place and people with a high degree of expertise treating these patients is really paramount. And, you know, to put in another plug for not directing public health resources away from those really needed activities and directing them towards public hysteria is certainly not in the best interest of stemming this epidemic. But I do see your point about how uncertainty can, you know, be something that is very, very frightening in an epidemic such as this one. But I think that with proper training, people can certainly follow cautious procedures, as a doctor in New York did, and report a fever as soon as it occurs and follow strict protocols. He did everything right and was not at all reckless in terms of exposing other people. And it just seems punitive to quarantine people for 3 weeks without any contact with people who may be able to make an informed decision towards being in contact with these people who, you know, are real people with families and jobs and lives in the United States or wherever their home country is.
But Dr. Farrell, what do you do about patients who lie, which apparently is the case involved with the patient in Texas who came in from Liberia? Apparently he lied to the officials in Liberia at the airport. Apparently there was, like, I think 5 different occasions where outgoing passengers were screened. And as far as I know, there's only one airliner now that's flying in and out of Liberia, and that's the Belgium airliner.
Yeah.
And apparently he lied on 5 different occasions there, and he had actually, not only had he taken a terminally ill Ebola patient to a hospital where she was turned away, he took her back in a cab where she was, you know, throwing up all over him, etc. And then he was probably less than forthcoming. And he certainly was less than forthcoming in his subsequent interviews at the hospital, apparently.
He didn't say
where he was in Africa, etc. So how do you get around that?
Well, I think that there is general screening, and then there's more active screening in the face of an epidemic. And, you know, what airports do is actually some form of active screening, but there's an argument that we may need to move towards more active screening. So that includes asking more pointed questions, looking more closely at people's travel history, and, you know, certainly checking them for a fever. I think that it's probably, it's quite frightening, but it's impractical in many cases to move towards anything more in-depth than that, because certainly the next step would then be quarantine, either brief or prolonged. I think that trying to make these measures seem as egalitarian as possible would be one step in the right direction. I think some people probably feel that they're being unfairly targeted as potential carriers of this virus, as scary as it is. And I think that the other thing is that when we go towards a one-size-fits-all quarantine for all returning healthcare workers or anyone suspected of being in contact with someone with Ebola or even coming from an area that carries a degree of risk, we create a lot of fear in an environment in which it may help people to lie about such a thing.
So what's your sense then of how we can get past this hysteria? I mean, apparently the sales of Clorox have spiked up, you know, by 30% or 50% in some cases. Sales of people buying sort of hazmat suits have spiked enormously. There's an enormous amount of irrationality going on. And I just wonder where the adult supervision is coming from. I know Dr. Fauci was very reasonable, but let's face it, very few Americans watch the Sunday morning Washington talk shows as much as people in my business wish they would and wish more would watch.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, it's certainly a scary time to be in, but it's a scary time in the same way that you know, SARS was scary several years ago, that anthrax was scary years before that, or that even, you know, the initial cases of HIV were many years before that. I think that trying to, through our public health networks, try to spread a very uniform message of calm preparedness is the best way forward. I think that people having a realistic idea about what to expect in terms of Ebola in the United States is key. I think that there will be more cases, and I think that there will be cases in cities that have not yet seen a case. Even in North Carolina, we are prepared, and we know that we will likely see someone with a possible or confirmed case of Ebola at UNC Healthcare. But I think making sure that the public is informed and that the public has realistic expectations about the ability of our healthcare system to handle these cases, and especially the existence of particularly prepared treatment centers such as those in Bethesda and in Atlanta and in other parts of the U.S. Is really essential. But I think that the sort of doomsday mentality is something that we've seen before with other significant public health threats or very communicable diseases. At the same time, we have other communicable diseases that are creating a good deal of concern and that we are also quite concerned about, such as MERS. So I think that having the public be on alert about communicable diseases can only be a good thing. But in the case of Ebola, people need to pay attention to public health messages and continue to make sure that they safeguard themselves through more routine public health measures.
Well, it would seem that people should listen to medical professionals and not to politicians. I mean,
certainly.
Governor Cuomo and Governor Christie, Cuomo apparently is, I don't understand how a politician can make these kind of sweeping decisions, but I guess he has the authority to do so without the sufficient input. And I suspect that as a politician, he's probably thinking, if I don't do this, people are going to come down on him. So he's feeding into the hysteria. Christie was unabashed and unapologetic, and he, of course, is campaigning, apparently running for president. So seems to be, in this political environment, it seems that what's going on here is that politicians are erring on the side of hysteria because the public is erring on the side of hysteria. Again, I'm calling here for some adult behavior.
No, I completely agree. And I think that when we look at these very few cases in the United States on an individual basis, I think we can think of a different chain of responses to each one of them that would have been more optimal, from people who contracted it in the United States to people who've returned with the virus from other countries. But I think that the variety of situations with which we've been presented, even in the few cases we've seen in the United States, illustrate how difficult it is to come up with a sweeping list of recommendations. I think that having everybody, as you said, stay vigilant and pay attention to reputable public health sources, and again, not to politicians and not to the popular news media, which may, also be changing the story somewhat in order to make a better headline, is very, very important.
Well, just in closing then, Dr. Claire Perrell, given that UN Ambassador Samantha Power is now in West Africa, she'll be visiting Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and there are pictures of her having a temperature taken, et cetera, and there's even some people saying that she should be quarantined on the way back.
But as we mentioned earlier, at least 5,000 people have died and at least 10,000 are infected. And this, I remember talking to the person in charge at the CDC when the first outbreak began in Sierra Leone some time back, or perhaps it was in Guinea. I'm not sure that I remember that correctly, but it was within the first few days and weeks that we talked, and it's just getting worse and worse, and it grows exponentially. So given what Dr. Fauci said, that we should be concerned about what's happening there and contain it there, because that has to be done, as opposed to overreacting here with very, very few cases involved when there are 10,000 in Africa. And then and that started from what, one case became 10,000. So at what point do we lose control of this situation if we don't focus on going after the source and dealing with it in West Africa?
Well, I think, you know, you used a very key word, which is exponential. I mean, you know, there was a very detailed set of projections made in a wonderful set of New England Journal articles earlier this month that estimated, even by the beginning of November, to have over 20,000 cases in total in that region, and continuing to increase from hundreds to thousands per week in the coming months.
So do you think that we've got a handle on it, that the world has got a handle on it?
Well, I don't know that the world has a handle on it. I think that there are a number of fantastic and hardworking organizations that are devoting an incredible amount of time and resources and very selfless attention to the cases in Africa. But I think the WHO put out a statement last week with their latest estimates of numbers, and they called it a deteriorating situation. And I think that was pretty apt. I mean, based on the New England Journal projections, this is a virus that is expected to continue on without much slowing in the coming months.
So what can we expect then? Will our UN ambassador, will she be the adult that might help us a little bit here, refocus our attention and redouble our efforts where help is really needed, not here in the United States, but in West Africa?
I hope that she can embody that hope, yes. I mean, you know, she can come back and she can follow public health recommendations to, you know, avoid unnecessary contact with people, to take her temperature, and to, you know, certainly avoid unnecessary exposure to the virus. But I think by, you know, being the voice of reason and bringing attention to the medical and humanitarian crisis there will hopefully help us somewhat with quelling hysteria in the United States.
Well, Dr. Claire Farrell, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Claire Farrell, who is an infectious disease physician and researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, where she serves as the medical director for the Infectious Diseases Clinic at UNC Healthcare.
And the very instructive but alarming projections that Dr. Farrell cited that are in the recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, they're available at nejm.org. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the key Senate races a week away. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who's a professor of history at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President.
His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
My great pleasure to be here.
And Alan, just to touch, I want to talk to you about the midterms, which are almost a little over a week away. But this forthcoming 2016 presidential election, according to the New York Times, both President Bush, the two presidents, 43 and 41, the father and brother of Jeb, are all excited about him running. So it's pretty likely that he's going to run. And we know that the guy that lost last time is running again, Mitt Romney. We also know that Hillary Clinton's running. Let's not be coy about that, although she's being coy. So, and with the Democratic left being skittish about Hillary and calling for Elizabeth Warren to run, what are the chances of a Jeb Bush winning, do you think?
Oh, it's way too early to tell. You know, I have my system called the Keys to the White House, which has correctly predicted the popular vote results of the last eight presidential elections since 84. But so many variables are still up in the air. We don't yet know the direction of the economy a couple of years hence. All kinds of foreign policy issues are still remaining to be resolved. We don't know the results of the midterm elections, another key. So I think it's way too soon to handicap this election. Sometimes you can handicap elections very early. I predicted the 2012 re-election of Barack Obama in January 2010, almost 3 years ahead of time. So, too, I predicted the fall of the Republican Party in 2008, almost 3 years ahead of time. But this one is one of the most uncertain presidential political situations that we're facing. It's an open seat, and many, many issues are still to be resolved.
Well, let's turn to the midterms and a week away, and they may not be over till January of 2015.
Well, that's right. You've got these strange laws in some states, in Louisiana and Georgia, for example. You have majority vote requirements. Louisiana has this wide-open primary where everyone can run, and you're going to have a runoff unless someone gets 50% or more, which is almost impossible. And Georgia also has a third candidate in the general election race and a majority vote requirement. So we may well be into January before we know who holds control of the United States Senate.
And wouldn't that mean if the control was up in the air after this November 4th election, would that mean then that there'll be enormous national attention and money to be pouring in to Georgia and or Louisiana?
And you got these two relatively small southern states, although Georgia's not that small, but it's not a California or New York or a Texas, and you're going to get California-style money coming in if control of the Senate was still in the balance and dependent on the results in Georgia and Louisiana. You know, the Koch brothers, Karl Rove on the one hand, and all of the Democratic interest groups on the other hand, will be pouring money into those two races.
But my understanding that these peculiar runoff requirements are vestiges of these sort of Jim Crow voter suppression rules that rigged to encourage or discourage people from voting and to make sure that few as possible people vote. And that is certainly the case in these off-year, particularly these special elections. Turnout is incredibly low. So will that be what it's all about? I mean, turnout...
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I think so. You know, midterms are always about turnout. And you're absolutely right. These so-called majority vote requirements are vestiges of Jim Crow, largely designed to make sure that, you know, if a African-American candidate can get a plurality in a field with several white candidates, ultimately they have to face off one-on-one against a white candidate, and they're going to lose. And they are set up, indeed, to diminish minority turnout, which does tend to fall off in these special elections that are not on the regular November schedule. So, indeed, the nature of these runoff elections structurally favor Republicans, who, of course, are not going to get minority votes in either of those places.
Well, and also on the other side, on the Democratic side, how do you inspire minority voters to come out when your candidates, the Democratic candidates in both Louisiana and Georgia, are running away from America's first African-American president as though he's got Ebola, and they're, you know, courting the white vote and ignoring the black vote.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Turnout's going to be very difficult for the Democrats to spark in both of those states, given which I think is an utterly futile strategy to run away from the president of your own party. Historically, that is not something that works real well. So the way you get turnout stimulated by minorities for Democrats in those contests is obviously to portray how bad the Republicans are. And you may not love these Democrats, but the Republicans are far worse for you.
So what is likely to happen? Also, you've got a couple of wild cards in South Dakota and Kansas. Now, apparently, Kansas is pretty much dominated by the Koch brothers. That's where they're headquartered. And Brownback, the governor, has been a perfect poster boy for ultra-right-wing policies, which have backfired to the point where he's deeply unpopular. And he's had to turn to the Koch brothers for unlimited funds. So has the incumbent Republican Senator Pat Roberts, who's also in trouble. But the independent running against him has not declared who he's going to caucus with, nor has Larry Pressler, a third-party candidate, even though he's a former Republican senator in South Dakota. He hasn't said he was going to caucus with. So those guys are keeping coy and keeping their powder dry.
Very smart on their part not to tip their hand. And who would have thought that Kansas would become a competitive race for Senator Roberts? Nobody. You know, that's such a bastion of Republicanism. But Democrats are hoping that Orman wins, the independent. Pressler really has no chance. He's running 30 points down in the polls. Are hoping that if he wins, he will in fact caucus with the Democrats. So Kansas could be a pickup for Democrats. South Dakota seems a little bit tougher. The Republican does seem to have staved off the challenges there and moved into a double-digit lead. But Georgia, as we've talked about, is a possible pickup for Democrats. And there's an even outside chance that the Democrats could oust Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, although, by God, they have so much money they're fighting against there.
Well, there's also a possibility in Iowa, isn't there? Joni Ernst is such a right-wing Tea Partier that she's, for example, denied that she's taking outside money, but she was recorded at the recent Koch brothers event that was secretly recorded out here in Orange County a few months back, talking about the Koch brothers' strategy and helping her. It's all on tape.
Iowa is too close to call. That's another one of those neck-and-neck races. Of course, it wouldn't be a net pickup for the Democrats, since I believe that's the seat previously held by the long-term Democratic incumbent there. But Republicans need Iowa. They need Kansas. They need to hold on to Georgia and Kentucky if they have any hope to take back the Senate. Right now, there are at least six or seven races that are absolutely too close to call. We've highlighted a bunch of them: Louisiana, Georgia, Kansas, Iowa, and you can add to that Arkansas, Colorado, North Carolina. It's very rare to see this many states up in the air, you know, almost a week before the election. It's just an extraordinary situation, and nobody knows what's going to happen. But another very odd thing about this election, despite the stakes, that is the Senate in question, this has been a remarkably issueless election. You know, it's basically been fought on attack strategies and negative ads with, as you say, a lot of the Democrats in Republican-leaning states running away from the president of their own party. And frankly, while the Republicans are yelling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, they haven't the faintest idea what they want to do about it.
But this is unusual, though, isn't it, in a sense, that it's this midterm, that it's a perfect storm against the Democrats. You have eight states in which the Democrats' incumbents are running for re-election in states that Mitt Romney carried in the last presidential election.
Right. It's not that unusual, because you're talking about the six-year point, which is always a difficult moment for a two-term president. You may recall Ronald Reagan in 1986 lost control of the Senate. Republicans had taken it in 1980. You recall in 2006, George W. Bush, the Republican, his party lost control over both houses. So the sixth year is always a very difficult year structurally because you often have a surge when the president is first elected. Obama in 2008 brought with him a lot of these Democratic senators in questionable Democratic states. Now they have to face re-election in a situation where you don't have the presidential surge working in their advantage. So the sixth year of a two-term president is probably the most difficult.
So given that historical fact and the fact that the president himself some time back said that Democrats have a genetic problem, they don't show up to vote in midterms, and that clearly is their problem.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the Republicans do show up and vote and the Democrats don't. So what is going to be done? I don't hear any inspiring words from anybody on the Democratic side.
There's nothing inspiring on either side. This is right. The most uninspiring, the most insipid, the most issueless election you can imagine. As I said, fought with big money to no end except to attack the opponent. Frankly, though, that can stimulate turnout. In other words, the voters can operate on two principles, greed and fear. And greed is obviously not happening here because no one's offering them much in a positive way, but it could be that fear does spur enough turnout to make a difference in some of these states. As I said, it's just too close to call in eight states right now.
Fear, of course, is being propagated by this notion that the Islamic State and Ebola are crossing the Mexican border. So that seems to be giving the Republicans a little bit of an advantage.
Yeah, it's utterly manufactured fear. I mean, this notion, you know, that somehow Ebola is tied into sealing the borders is, you know, absolute and utter nonsense. It's fear snatched out of nowhere, but, you know, people are susceptible to these kinds of things. It's interesting, you know, all of the fears being raised by the Republicans, none of them have a basis in reality. Not Ebola, not the economy, not Obamacare, not the border, where border crossings have been sharply down in recent years, but facts don't seem to matter a whole lot in these political debates.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a professor of history at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the likely impact of a letter from 12 Nobel laureates to President Obama urging him to release the long delayed report on torture. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. His forthcoming book is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Scott, the letter from 12 Nobel Peace Prize laureates urging President Obama to make a full disclosure to the American people of the extent of the use of torture by the United States, and in particular focusing on the release of the long-delayed Senate Intelligence Committee report on the CIA's torture and rendition regime that followed the September 11th attacks on the United States. This joint letter was organized by two of the laureates, Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa and former President Jose Ramos Horta of East Timor, and it's part of a broader online petition campaign at thecommunity.com. So what's its likely impact, do you think?
Well, I think it shows that that this process, that is the process of issuance of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's report on torture, is being monitored very closely all around the world. And it shows a high level of frustration with the Obama White House, which promised one thing, promised it rather passionately, and really hasn't come through. So I think it focuses attention on Obama's shortcomings, and it uses the fact that he's a Nobel laureate himself, a recipient of the Peace Prize, as a way of doing it. You know, will it have consequences in the end? Unclear. But I would say right now the stumbling block for this report is inside the White House, and in particular it's the president's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, who has been the person managing the redaction and has effectively, rather than being a broker between the Senate and the CIA, he has been plainly an aggressive, zealous advocate for the CIA, trying to slow walk or even stop issuance of the report. So I think it's definitely going to put a spotlight on him.
And the report itself is apparently 6,300 pages. And what they're talking about releasing is a 480-page executive summary of the report. Is that that's my understanding?
That's exactly correct. It's only the executive summary that we're talking about, because President Obama came out and said he's for releasing the report, and his aides had to scramble within minutes thereafter to say, well, he didn't really mean that. He really meant only the executive summary. And then the question has been how much of the executive summary can be released, because the CIA has been redacting it with the intention of making it incomprehensible by cutting off names, places, dates, and so forth, so that what you get in the end is gibberish that just doesn't mean anything. And that's what they take focus on in their letter. They're really quite focused on the redaction process. And they're saying, no, the American people and the people of the world need to know the basic facts, and you can't redact them into oblivion.
But, I mean, who would read a 6,300-page report in the first place? I mean, I'm not putting the report down because I'm sure sounds like they've done a very thorough job. But it's so extraordinary to gather all that information and then to sit on it. And then to not even allow the summary of all this information to see the light of day.
Well, I think that's right. But who would read it? I think you'd be surprised. I think there are a lot of people eager to get their hands on it and read it. And that's not just historians, but a lot of people who are studying the question of the effects and consequences of this program. That's a very momentous issue. And there are claims that have been made quite aggressively by the agency and by people, former people from the agency, who claim that the program was effective, that it did result in an actionable intelligence, that it helped even lead to open the trail to Osama bin Laden. But others who've reviewed the report and reviewed the files say that none of that is true. In fact, it quite plainly says exactly the opposite. So I think there are quite a few people who will be keen to wade through all those details and see the answer. And also, I think, this program went on in different countries around the world. So you've got a whole series of different chapters. You have things that went on in Thailand and Morocco and Jordan, in Romania, Poland, and Lithuania, for instance. And I think you've got people who've been on the track of what went on there who are very, very eager to see what this report says. And the redaction is, in fact, designed to block exactly that. I mean, they do not want readers to know that this passage is talking about what went on in a CIA black site in Lithuania or a CIA black site in Poland.
But in effect, the Obama administration and his chief of staff are protecting the Bush-Cheney administration. They're the ones that went off out on this torture rampage, and there was a change at the CIA where all the Arabic speakers were purged, the ones that actually knew this area and knew the people and knew the cultures. They were purged, and they brought in these guys from Latin America, led by this guy Rodriguez, who is the champion of torture and who wrote a book proudly proclaiming his success, in quotes, of torture. And they, of course, had experience torturing in these the wars of the 1980s in Central America. And look where that that got us, you know. So I don't understand why is Obama protecting Bush and in particular Cheney?
Well, I think there are a lot of Obama's political supporters who ask exactly that question. They don't get it. They don't understand it. Why he's doing that? But I think we're skipping over some important facts here. And I'd say probably at the top of the list is the fact that many of these people who were involved in the torture in the black site program rose to the very top of the agency. So if you look at the uppermost echelons in the agency, the head of the counterterrorism center, the head of station, Alec, the senior staff lawyer, Robert Ettinger, who's mentioned over and over again in this report. 1,600 times Mr. Ettinger's name appears. People who were involved in this program were advanced well ahead of their contemporaries as a way of protecting them. So if you look at the uppermost echelons of the CIA today, it's filled with alumni of the torture and black sites program. So there's a high level of anxiety amongst those people in particular that they will be exposed. I think most of them already realize they can't travel outside the United States. And the instant they do, they're susceptible of being arrested and prosecuted. So they're grounded in the U.S. already. And I think they're very, very concerned about guarding their anonymity to the extent they can. So what we understand, item number one in the pushback has been no names to be mentioned, even though there are roughly 20 CIA agents involved in this program whose names are already known, and it's not exactly what roles they played. There's adamance that this report may not name them.
I've spoken, Scott, with Glenn Carl, a CIA officer who was involved in one of the black sites, and I think it was somebody that was supposed to be like number three in Al Qaeda. You know, the joke is that that's the worst job in the world to have, the number three in Al Qaeda, because they keep, zapping the number three with a drone, and suddenly another number three comes along. There's an endless supply of number threes. But this guy was supposedly some high up, and Glenn Carl told me that immediately he realized this guy was innocent. They had the wrong guy, Washington kept saying, "Well, he's being deceptive. He's trained to be that way." So ignore his proclamations of innocence and ramp up the torture. That was the logic.
In fact, I can tell you, Glenn could not give you the name of the person who was involved. I can give you his name. His name was Pasha Wazir. And Ron Suskind wrote a book in which he identified him by name. His capture was cited by senior figures in the intelligence community as one of the great coups of the agency's financial counterterrorism operation. In fact, it was the biggest single coup. And in fact, a number of people got job promotions, and the budget of that task force was greatly increased based on their having landed Pasha Wazir. So, of course, when it turned out that Pasha Wazir was not who they thought he was, he was not the senior financial manager for Al Qaeda. And in fact, although Al Qaeda probably did manage some money transfers using the Hawa system that he was involved with, it seemed very unlikely that he even knew that. It was something like, imagine that Osama bin Laden went one day to Grand Central Station and purchased a ticket to go to Ossining, and then you say on the basis of that that the ticket clerk who sold him that ticket was the transit manager for al-Qaeda. It was something like that that was going on with Pasha Wazir. And there was an absolute refusal to accept that they made a mistake. And that's something we see over and over and over again. And the refusal has largely to do with, with careerism within the agency. I mean, people build their careers in advance based on claimed accomplishments. They will not accept that their accomplishment didn't occur.
Well, the letter from the 12 Nobel Peace Prize laureates to President Obama, which was organized by Archbishop Desmond Tutu and former President Jose Ramos Horta of East Timor. Just to quote a little bit of it. In recent decades, by accepting the flagrant use of torture and other violations of international law in the name of combating terrorism, American leaders have eroded the very freedoms and rights that generations of their young gave their lives to defend. They have again set an example that will be followed by others. Only now, it is one that will be used to justify the use of torture by regimes around the world, including against American soldiers in foreign lands. In losing their way, they have made us all vulnerable. Now, that's incredibly reasonable and quite rational, and that's been my greatest outrage about what the Bush and Cheney have done, is that they've allowed all of these crooks and criminals and torturers around the world that run these criminal regimes to basically say, wait a minute, the Americans do it, so what are you complaining about, you know?
And indeed, if you look at senior figures in the U.S. military, including the heads of the JAG Corps from all the four service branches, they made exactly that point. They said that if we adopt these techniques and we say it's legal, then we're also saying that other powers around the world are free to do this to our service personnel when they're captured. And we can't do that. That's against our own interests. And if we look at what's going on today with ISIS in Syria and Iraq, there was a really dramatic story published by the New York Times over the weekend of the torment to which some of these journalists were subjected before they were executed. And you can go through and look at the brutalization, mock killings, and so forth. Well, item after item of what ISIS does, it are things that were approved for use by the CIA and were used by the CIA on prisoners. And this is not coincidental. I mean, ISIS is mocking these CIA techniques. They're imitating them. They're repeating them. And well, they're making the point that if the U.S. can do it, we can do it.
Well, of course, they dressed these journalists that they beheaded in orange jumpsuits, and they did waterboard them. Obviously, they didn't need to get any information out of them. I'm sure they were more than willing to tell their captors whatever they wanted to know. But so it's pretty clear that they're signaling to us what they're why they're doing and what they're doing.
I think that's right. I mean, another thing to keep in mind here is that the U.S. is up for review now before the Committee Against Torture. That's happening in the next couple of weeks. And I think that's probably a major reason why this letter has been issued. It's putting the question very pointedly to the U.S. government just in advance of that meeting. At the same time, when the U.S. government, it has become known, as reported in the New York Times, is considering reverting back to the position taken by the Bush administration that the Convention Against Torture does not apply outside of the United States, so that there's no applicability to it in connection with U.S. operations overseas, which would be basically all CIA operations.
So under whose auspices is this new committee meeting?
Well, the Committee Against Torture has periodic reviews. Every 5 years they review. So the U.S. is up this year together with many others. So it's a bureaucratic standard procedure. And the issue being raised within the U.S. is really shocking because, of course, the legal advisor at the U.S. Department of State, Harold Coe, had written a 90-page memorandum explaining why this position was completely wrong and indefensible. Coe has gone back to academia now, and we see with his departure an almost automatic reversion back to Bush positions.
Well, one of the things that Glenn Carl told me was that before he was sent to this black site, and I mean, he can't even tell me where it was, even though it's pretty obvious where it was, and I'm sure you know where it was too. He went to his boss at the CIA and said, "Where's the justification? I want a presidential finding, so that I'm not going to go to jail for following orders." And they literally gave him John Yoo's bizarre letter. You know, his justification. This guy at I don't know whether he's still at Berkeley Law School, but you know, that was the finding. This extraordinary, convoluted piece of writing by John Yoo.
Yeah, John Yoo is not only at Berkeley Law School now, he's just been given a named professorship at the law school. And you're right. I mean, these letters, this memorandum was issued by John Yoo not as an abstract exercise in legal scholarship, but it was written to induce officers of the CIA to torture. It was written because many of them, just as the case as occurred with Glenn Carl, but occurred many, many other times, many officers, when they were told to use these procedures, responded, "That can't possibly be legal. It's obviously not legal, and I'm not going to do it unless you give me documents showing that the Justice Department has said it's legal." So that explains the context in which you wrote. And the black sites, by the way, he was at were in just outside of Rabat, the first set of interrogations, and the second occurred at a brick factory just north of Kabul.
Well, Scott Horton, this is a sorry chapter, and I imagine, you know, a lot of people are arguing inside. Probably the president's chief of staff is probably saying, you know, if we release this report, it's just going to give the jihadis more reason to behead Americans. But on the other hand, you know, you have to it clearly. The fact that the U.S. has given a green light to every miserable despot around the world that they're free to torture outweighs those considerations. And do you think this is ever going to see the light of day?
I think the answer is yes, it will. And I think, you know, the Nobel laureates, they have their finger on the pulse and they make exactly the right arguments. That is, you know, the fact that these practices exist and the fact that the U.S. hasn't effectively distanced itself from them by coming clean propagates torture. It gives support to those who want to use torture. So it's exactly the opposite of this argument you just suggested for Dennis McDonough. And I think Barack Obama has suggested repeatedly he understands that.
Right.
You know, what we hear is a sort of concern about the loyalty of the CIA. And CIA officers, and I would just say I think that's seriously misplaced. I mean, I don't doubt their loyalty to the United States. And I think if the law and the president are one thing and that's what the government adheres to,
sure.
I think the CIA will obey.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His forthcoming book is Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.